motion or the board back into order. With that, we'll go to agenda item 6, the information items and presentations. Agenda item 6A is customer information and billing system replacement information update. Dan.
Thank you, President Sullivan. Charles and I are happy to present this first quarterly update to the board with regard to our CIS implementation. I'll start with a little bit of background to catch you up again on this project. The board approved our project kickoff in July of this year, and there are three primary components to this initiative. One is to replace our 28-year-old customer information system, COINS. It is also to implement the customer self-service portal functionality that Laura spoke to earlier, and Charles will share a bit more with you here in a moment. And then also to implement a mobile work management component that will enable our field personnel that are working with the meters and the accounts technology access to the system through that application. This is approximately a two-year project, 20 months of development and implementation, and then a four-month post-go-live support is envisioned. So it's a two-year initiative for us. So again, just by way of background, as you may recall, back in December of 2017, we initiated this with the board authorization to contract with AAC Utility Partners. AAC assisted us in developing system requirements for the new customer information system. I've shared with you before that that was nearly 3,000 line items of requirements for this application. They also assisted us in the system selection and contract negotiations. So with that system selection, we released an RFP back in July of 2018, and we had a very competitive response. We received 9 proposals, and through the evaluation and selection process, we ended up recommending Kyanta Utilities as the district's future CIS product. So importantly, in addition to the system itself, you know, a project of this size and magnitude requires a number of supporting elements, and the board authorized us to proceed with that back in March of this year. So we had issued a solicitation for project management services, and we have project management support that is being provided by AAC. We have change management support that is working with not only the customer service team that is directly impacted and involved with this, but other district departments in implementing a change of this significance. We have a third-party quality assurance company, and that company comes in on a monthly basis, ends a week with the project team and with us in the senior management, and reports to the project health and that sort of thing. Been a useful tool so far. We also have training and development coordination, as well as testing development and capabilities technology for deployment. So that contract negotiation was completed, I should say, in June of this past year, and we officially launched the project in July. So one of the first accomplishments of the project team was really to establish our organizational structure. So our project is led by an executive steering committee. Paul is on that committee, Laura, myself, Charles Kimweru, as well as Mike Malone. We are the executive steering committee that is responsible for the overall administration of this project. We also have, and we've introduced these to the board previously, but a very strong core team here. This is boots on the ground staff that are 100% dedicated over this two-year period to implementing the CIS project. We have representation from customer service, from billing, from IT, from finance, from meters. It is a very well put together team. We were very pleased with the staff that we have assigned to this project. Very dedicated group. And then we also, part of that change management component, we also have a group of project ambassadors, and those are representatives from departments throughout the organization that may not be directly impacted by the CIS replacement, but have a need for awareness and to share that information with what's going on with this initiative. So that's our project ambassador group. And then really, the kickoff was led through our project governance or our charter. And there's four key components of that charter. What are we expecting to achieve here? And really, it begins with improving the customer experience. And we spoke before about our self-service portal. You saw a demonstration of that in our last presentation. That is really the bottom line of what we're trying to achieve here, is improve that customer experience. We're implementing modern functionality that will improve our internal efficiencies. We've already identified certain areas that can be streamlined and modified by use of a current, more modern system. Enable efficient business management now and in the future. So one of the challenges that we've had with that 28-year-old application is adapting to changes in the marketplace. And we've talked at length about cell phones that we're all carrying were really in place at the time that this existing billing application that we have was put into service. And then lastly, to provide a modern platform that can easily integrate with other district applications. So we believe we are well underway with achieving those initiatives, that charter, and we'll share our first quarterly update. I'm going to ask Charles to present to you where we're at with the project and some of the key milestones that we've achieved.
Thank you, Dan. Good morning, President Sullivan, members of the board. So I want to mention, you know, that the first phase of the project was for us to set the project structure, define the roles and responsibilities, and have the governance documents in place. The next thing we looked at is what project management tool are we going to use and metrics to manage our project accordingly. So as Dan mentioned, you know, we're using AAC for those lead project management roles, and with that, we also get the benefit of using their project management tool, which is called IQ. This system really does give us executive level dashboard and progress reporting that any member of the leadership team that's associated with this project can easily log in and track the progress of this project. The other really neat thing about this tool is it acts as our document repository, and to date, or at least at the time we prepared this presentation, we have close to 400 project assets that have been created by that core team and that project team, and those are stored in this one central place. To put that in perspective, had we not had a system like this in place, those are 400 documents that are saved in email, printouts. I joked last time, you know, they'll be on floppy disks, if you would. So again, one central place for us to manage all the project assets, and I think it's a very powerful tool. And I'll be showing you a couple of the other screens here, and I'm sure you'll agree with me. And then the last thing about this tool, it allows for easy management of our deliverables that are associated with this project, and we'll talk a little bit more about that here in a bit. So the IQ system, you know, we talk about the deliverables, and what's important to note here that each phase of our project has specific deliverables that have to be met. And the core team has a very detailed process to receive those deliverables, to review those deliverables, accept the deliverables, and then we get a sign off on those deliverables to ensure that, you know, there's nothing really being left on the table that hasn't been addressed. As I mentioned, each phase has specific deliverables assigned to it, and what you'll see here is in the planning phase, we have 35 planned deliverables, and I'm happy to report that all 35 were completed as planned and on time. The phase that we're currently in is the analysis phase, and we have a total of 16 deliverables, and we're well on our way. At the time we put this together, we had 20 deliverables completed. And before this phase ends in the end of January 2020, those 68 deliverables will all be completed as well. And then here, just some screenshots of, again, those dashboards and tools that any member of the team that's working on the project can easily log in and track the progress of the report of the project. Excuse me. The next thing I wanted to highlight is our ADI logs, or actions, decisions, and issues logs, if you will. And so as you can imagine, on a project of this magnitude, there's action items that need to be assigned through the many workers of the team, decisions that need to be made, and issues identified. And the power of this tool allows us to assign owners to those items and due dates. So there's reminders that go out, and the project management team can follow up on those key members that have been assigned to those ADI logs, keeping us again on track and ensuring that nothing has been left unaddressed. The team has really adopted to this methodology, and as you'll see there, there's 98 items that have been logged to date with 84 of them completed. So, you know, we're identifying issues, we're assigning them to project members, and we're addressing those items quickly. Other item I I wanted to touch on today is COVID management. This is one that I keep very close to the vest because the scope creep is one that can really derail a project of this magnitude. Dan mentioned the project chart and our scope statement. We have very detailed processes that the team has to follow to submit a change request, for example. And I'm happy to report that today we've had 6 change requests that have had no impact to the project cost, project schedule, or the scope of our project. And one might ask, you know, give me an example of one of those changes that didn't impact the cost or the scope or schedule of the project. And one is this tool that I'm talking about here this morning, the IQ system. We had initially planned to release that to the team in month 3 of the project, but realizing the benefit that this brings to the project, we pushed that up to month 2, and because that was a change to our schedule as to when this deliverable was going to be delivered, we produced a change request, but that did not have any impact to the scope, schedule, or cost. So that's an example of one of those change requests. So, you know, a short four months I think it has been, and quite a bit of activity has gone on in that time. So to highlight some of the accomplishments that the team has produced so far, the schedule has been finalized with over 3,000 rows of activity that needs to be completed. Now this is a working document that we'll continue to modify throughout the project, but that is a document that's been finalized, and the team does periodically look at that to ensure that we're looking ahead on the activity that's coming. There's also a document that's shared with the Executive Steering Committee, and we can also share that with us as needed. The core team, top picture to the right, they completed the CIS system training, so the Kayenta system training, and that was a prerequisite to the phase that they run now to kind of review the configuration workshops. So they need to understand how does the system work before we can actually review the configuration and how do we configure those requirements. Next item on here, I know this is one that is very close to Dr. Pauly's heart, is the customer self-service portal. And Laura did mention that under the November 18th new release phase 1, the soft launch that we're calling is to 47 staff members, while also district customers. And we're definitely on track to release this to customers top of the year. Dr. Pauly will definitely set up some time to walk you through that as needed. One thing that's important to note about this early release is phase one produces or at least gives the customers access to their usage data and ease of payment submission, if you will. Phase two, as Dan mentioned, is a 20-month project. When we complete the CIS project, customers will have the full host of options that's available through the customer self-service portal. Options such as move in and move out, they'll be able to do that from the ease of their portal and things like adjusting their variances, let's say. But that's not until phase two of the customer portal. And then also completed were the executive level change management interviews that I know Laura and others were a part of that as well. So Dan mentioned, we're utilizing a third party called Plamorant to run quality health check on our project. And the goal really is to evaluate how the project is progressing and what is overall health of our CS replacement project. And then how do we do that, or how do they do that? So as Dan mentioned, the interview, the project team, when they're here once a month for executive steering committee. They also attend weekly project management meetings and also have reviewed project-related documents. And so once they're done with that activity, they then rate their findings with a simple red, yellow, green highlighted here. Green being everything's on target, keep doing what you're doing. Yellow is items that are below target and it might need the project management office to mitigate, and then red is we need to escalate beyond the project management team. So the first health report, I'm happy to report, for the most part, we were actually, a lot of it, we're healthy green. There are two items on there that have a little bit of yellow on them, and I'll discuss that here shortly. But you know, Dan mentioned the roles and responsibilities. You just shared the organization structure. People know what they're supposed to be doing. The project workspace, Dr. Paul, you visited the customer service department. We showed you where, as we joke, where the magic is happening. Vendor relationships, you know, there's quite a bit of vendors that are working on this. And at the time that this was produced, that relationship was in the green. Project management and issue remediation. The schedule, again, as I mentioned, 3,000 roles of activity that's been tracked. Communication has been really tied, and I want to commend April and her group for helping us continue that communication, but we have internal pipeline and external to customers. And then the executive management team, again, we mentioned that Paul and Laura do attend our monthly meetings, and their support there is well noted. So the two items that are flagged, that were flagged as yellow, so the delivery acceptance process, what we found is while the deliverables were being delivered, the process was not being followed to the T, if you will. And the recommendation there was to review the statement of work with the entire project team to ensure that, you know, while we're continuing to deliver those deliverables, we also need to make sure that we are following the process as defined in the statement of work. So we completed that late last week, and we're confident that the team is now on the same page and this issue has been resolved. The next item was related to the customer portal from a scheduling perspective. We did lose a key member who left the district from the Public and Government Affairs Department. And again, I want to commend April for quickly jumping in and filling in that gap that was experienced, and we really didn't experience too big of a hiccup. We continued to work with our payment processor, Kubra, who typically is a little slow to move on items such as this, but we escalated appropriately and we were able to deliver on the items that were due from them. And then lastly, we confirmed Go Live resources for that January Go Live that we talked about. So to talk about the budget now, as you may recall, in July of this year, the board approved the entire budget of $17.5 million to get us through the project. And what we're highlighting here are the major buckets, if you will, of all the key players that are helping us manage this project. What I want to draw your attention to is the actual column here in the middle. To date, at least the time that we produced this report, we've spent $1.6 million, and that's without the MWD cost. And another view of this is to show the anticipated spend rate. And what I'm going to draw your attention to is on the bar graph, the green bar is our actual spend, and the purple is what was planned. And you'll note that actual is coming in under planned. And one reason for that is our lead project manager from AAC, as an example, he relocated to Southern California. So the district is saving on travel costs there, and that's reflected here on this graph. So looking ahead, I think we've talked about the customer portal. You can tell we're really excited about it. So we completed our testing, training, and we released it to internal customers, as I mentioned, in November. And we're well on our way to going live in January, phase one customers. And between now and then, we'll continue to work with Public and Government Affairs to continue to communicate with our customers by way of inserts, emails, newsletters, and things of that nature. That way our customers, you know, we generate a little bit of excitement. And we can get good adoption when we do release this to the customers. I mentioned the current phase right now that the core team is working through is the analysis and configuration phase, kind of sitting through workshops, reviewing those 2,500 requirements that we identified in the selection phase and making sure that we disposition all of those and get a good understanding of how we're going to configure the system to address those requirements. And that phase is set to end at the end of January 2020. And then from a change management perspective, I think this is one that is just ongoing, both at the leadership level and staff level. We want to make sure that we continue to inform them of what this change is and take temperature checks, if you will, to ensure that everybody is aware of what the change is and how it impacts their day-to-day once we go live. And with that, all the difficult questions can go to Dan, and I'll take them.
Okay. Got any questions of Charles?
So what do you think the life of this system is?
We've planned for at least 20 years with the system.
And is there some sort of a maintenance contract to provide?
Yeah, we do have a maintenance contract, and Mike and I'm going to speak to you about that.
Well, it's as is common with most off-the-shelf software, you've typically got a support and maintenance agreement in place for the application. In this case, it's I believe 17 or 18% of the purchase cost of the software. So each year we're paying roughly 17 or 18% of that upfront purchase cost for support and maintenance.
Is that for a license, or is that to maintain the
so
license?
So you have your initial license costs, and then support and maintenance is some fraction of that. In this case, I believe it hovers around 17 or 18%.
And that also includes the software updates over time to maintain the system over the longer term.
Yes.
Did that answer your question, Director?
So it's hardware-based and not... So it's software-based, not hardware-based. There's very little hardware to this.
There's a considerable amount of hardware, but the hardware is already part of the district's enterprise infrastructure, so we're basically just applying this application into that existing infrastructure.
Okay. So it's not separate and distinct where you'd have to...
That's
hardware right. Continually upgrades itself every year, so
right.
This is just part of what we would do as a normal upgrade to our own equipment.
That's correct.
For overall enterprise.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Not just customer service and billing.
Right.
So, Charles, could I summarize by saying you are on time and under budget?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Charles, good presentation. I can tell you were especially nervous, though, this time. Because you were afraid Director Record was going to point out your shirt, I think.
Oh.
You made it.
I have no issue with that shirt.
My name's called the Blue Chocolate, so. Thanks, so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Charles.
Okay, with that, we'll go to Agenda Item 6B, which is the Santa Ana River Conservation and Conjunctive Use Program Update. Brian.
Good morning, President Sullivan, members of the board. As you've seen before, we've been working on the what we call the SARCUP program for a number of years now. And along the way, we've reached a series of milestones. So what I'm presenting on today is another one of those major milestones. We'll start out with the status of the SARCUP program, and then talk about the MWD SARCUP operating agreement, as well as the status or an update of the MWD's project, and then our next steps. So in terms of the status, this is the current configuration of storage within the Santa Ana River watershed. The majority is in the San Bernardino area. Next would be Orange County's, and then the San Jacinto Basin is the third largest of the basins. That's also shown here on the left in terms of the volumes of storage that will be available, and then the allocation of storage between the agencies. I like this slide because it shows, gives you a feel for the size of the SARCUP water bank relative to other surface water reservoirs. And as you can see, we're right there with the size of Lake Paris, and we're larger than the Silverwood and Big Bear Lakes, which are also nearby.
So San Vicente, is that after they raised the dam?
The numbers for San Vicente, that's the increment from the dam raising, I believe, isn't it?
You know, I don't know.
That's right, because I thought that was the increment from the incremental cost from the dam raising.
Okay.
But we'll, or the incremental volume added for the dam raising. But I'll get that. We'll get that for you, Randy.
So in terms of the agreement between Metropolitan and the SARCUP agencies. We've been preparing a term sheet that basically outlines the purpose of the agreement, which would be to document the deliveries of State Water Project water surplus from Valley Agency. And so Metropolitan has a separate agreement with Valley where they can purchase surplus water. And then our agreement's going to basically follow on to that agreement and dictate what happens when the water that Metropolitan buys is offered to the SARCUP agencies. So it outlines the relationship there and then identifies methods of put and take of that water into the groundwater basin. And then basically we're documenting that we're consistent with MWD's administrative policy as well as their policies on extraordinary supply. So in all cases, MET buys the water from Valley and they pay rates based on the agreement that they have between Valley and MET. And then basically that agreement says that up to 50% of the water shall be provided or offered to the SARCUP member agencies. So when we buy that water from Metropolitan, we would pay the full service rate. And that uses the MET facilities, or in some cases it uses what MET calls a virtual meter. Now that allows them to bill for the water and have a meter to reference. And then we've identified certain put scenarios here. We've got three of them. That includes direct MWD delivery, indirect MET delivery, and then delivery to Valley. So we've broken it down into three basic categories there. On the take side, we've identified two scenarios where it involves MET. There's also a third scenario where it's just direct usage by the local agency. And all of these put and take scenarios are described in the operating term sheet, and they'll be part of the agreement that we'll be drafting here shortly. We've identified five separate examples that use combinations of the different put and take scenarios. So it does get very complicated. We're not going to go into that here. But the term sheet that was attached to this board item does cover what's involved with those. So some of the major terms involve, again, MET purchasing the water from Valley, MET making an equivalent amount of that water, 50% available to the SARCUP agencies, and then MET and Valley having their separate agreement. In certain cases, the SARCUP agencies will be able to purchase more than 50%, and that's if Metropolitan doesn't want to take delivery of their 50%. And then the water will be designated as extraordinary supply, and it'll have to comply with MET's terms on the use of extraordinary supply. So the benefits to Metropolitan, basically, we're paying the full service rate to MET, so they're not losing a sale by doing this. It reduces the burden on MET to expand for storage capacity. So with no cost to MET, we're expanding the ability to store water in the service area. It benefits all of the MET member agencies. And then we have certain examples, Form 5, where Metropolitan's infrastructure is not used. So if they have any capacity limitations, we can get around those and deliver water to the Valley Bank. And then in Example 5, MET will have a call provision on up to 50% of the water, which is another benefit to MET. So we've had a number of meetings with MET staff on this, and along the way we've made progress. At our last meeting, we basically reached a tentative agreement on the term sheet, and we met with Devin, and he basically agreed with all of the final terms that we've got in the term sheet. So we're moving that forward. We're developing a draft agreement, and then we'll be sharing that with the SARCUP agencies soon, and then that'll be going to all of our legal staffs very soon as well. We have a schedule to bring that back to the board here, and we've been working with Met staff on the timing of taking it to the Met board. In terms of our physical project, it involves the three well sites, 201, 202, and 203, the recharge facility, Mountain Avenue West, as well as a treatment and blending facility. So all three wells have been drilled at this point. They've been drilled and then capped off. And so that's the three wells there. And all, the drilling is all complete. The sound walls are down, so it's ready to start construction of the wellhead facilities. This is a rendering of the proposed Mount Avenue West recharge site. So as you can see, we've got two recharge ponds in the facility, as well as one desilting channel that we're where we hope all the silt settles out of the water. So we only have that desilting channel that we have to clean up, and we don't have to keep cleaning up the ponds. So next steps in terms of the agreement, SAPA is working with DWR on amendment number 2, which will redefine some of the projects. Some of the money moved from IUA to Orange County, and so they're going to be drilling some wells. So that's that, and a two-year extension is going to be part of the second amendment with DWR. And then we're going to be working with the SARCUP agencies and Metropolitan to finalize the term sheet and then get the agreement drafted and executed. So if there's any questions. Like I said, this was a major milestone that we reached here. We're really excited that this is behind us.
Any questions?
Just a comment. I really like that one graph that shows the capacity of storage compared to other facilities.
And through the magic of the internet, we've determined that that increment is the amount of the increase. Okay. So San Vicente Dam was originally only 90,000, or San Vicente Reservoir when it was built in the 40s was originally 90,000 acre feet. The capacity now is 242,000 acre feet, so that was the increment to increase the capacity.
But you're showing DDL, it's the full capacity, so.
Yeah, these are total capacity.
Okay.
Yeah. But it's interesting, our project is comparable to the San Vicente Dam enlargement project.
It's a little bit less.
A little bit less expensive. We didn't put the unit costs on there.
No. but it offers us a great deal of flexibility in terms of, you know, water we can recharge. You know, it supports our PWR program. There's a lot of benefits to this. Gives us an emergency supply.
Well, I understand all that. I'm just saying that for the money invested in infrastructure, it's a steal.
It's a great deal.
Right.
We're also really appreciative of the Met staff. They worked through this. This is not a uncomplicated project. It requires in-lieu deliveries with Met. And they helped us work through that. But I think from our perspective, we approached this that we wanted to have the way in which we move water in and out of the bank be fully compliant with the State Water Project contract relative to San Bernardino Valley water and to be compliant with Met's administrative code. So I think that kind of laying that as our goal up front really helped us work through with the Met staff. You know, we anticipate they will take the Valley agreement sometime next year to the Met board. This will be a sub-agreement really to the Valley agreement that allows the surplus water to be provided from Valley to Metropolitan. But we're really excited about this. This is a big project for the district, and I think the work with Metropolitan on this has been long, but I think we've come up with a really good program that up and down the chain at Metropolitan they're supportive of. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
All right, with that, let's go to agenda item 6C, which is the state legislative update. Danielle.
Hello again. So it is absolutely my pleasure to present to you our state and federal legislative report. I say that mostly because this literally represents closing the book on the 2019 year and transitioning to the second year of the two-year legislative session. So it's a big deal. But it's not only a big deal to us, but in that manner, it's also a big deal because it provides an opportunity to highlight and feature what some of your investments and support mean to the legislative program. To the numbers, Eastern reviewed 155 bills this last year with our expert resources. We submitted 712 letters of support, opposition, or concern, and we participated in 12 association work groups where we provided more in-depth discussion and drafted legislation. EMWB's general manager and staff testified as expert witnesses at 6 public hearings, and our Sacramento advocates testified a number of times in the Me Too capacity at several hearings of priority bills. So that's just a primer of some of where we've been this past year. So going to the report of the state oversight starts on page 19. I'm going to provide the federal conclusions, or the state conclusion today. Jolene's going to come next month and provide the federal update. So the legislative year from the state side concluded on September 13th. The governor had 30 days to review the various bills that made it to his desk. He had 30 days. October 13th was the last day for him to consider bills. He considered 1,042 bills, where he signed 870 of them, and he vetoed 172 for roughly a 16% veto record. On the specifics of what happened following my last presentation to you, as you know, SB 414, our sponsored legislation, was made a two-year bill while it was in the Assembly Appropriations Committee. So, good news is, when the legislature starts back up in January, we'll be in that spot again. We've already passed the House of Origin deadline, so we'll be a good spot. It allows for us to continue our ongoing negotiations on our bill. Also on the consolidation front, AB 508 passed out of the legislature. This bill expands the existing force consolidation requirements to allow for the state board to force the consolidation of an individual well serving a disadvantaged community. On the CPUC side, also in the consolidation realm, AB 1751 by Assembly Member Chu was passed, and this sort of streamlines the CPUC process for consolidations of their systems that they provide oversight to. On more of the regulatory side or the administrative side, the state board did adopt an administrative handbook administrator handbook for the appointment of a system administrator. Where a system is failing, they can appoint an administrator to take over, either in a limited term or on a longer term, could be project specific. There was some concerning elements in the handbook that was finally adopted because it does require extensive outreach and information gathering and development prior to the actual placement of the administrator. And since that is an element that is supposed to be in place to address sort of a system in crisis, it kind of precludes that from moving very quickly. OEA also initiated a process on assessing the human right to water for all California water systems. This does look at a system's opportunities to provide water in a safe, an accessible, affordable, and water quality manner. This effort does have a related web tool, and the audience for this report is intended to be the legislature, the public, and the media. So we have been deeply engaged in the development of the report by OEHA. Switching over to the environmental side, at the conclusion of the legislative session, SB1 was the last bill that really had a lot of concerning elements for the water community. As you know, it did impact the voluntary settlement agreements. That bill did pass out of the legislature, where it was ultimately vetoed by the governor. on the wildfire side, clearly one of the issues that took up a lot of room in the legislature. AB 1054 and 111 were signed back in July. Those were the overarching bills that addressed sort of the high priority elements of the wildfire discussion. Of course, it did not discuss inverse condemnation. There was opportunity for possibly looking at that process at the tail end of the legislative session, but it was just too big of a lift to conclude at that point in the session. Other efforts on the wildfire front include 8167, which expands notification procedures for the medically vulnerable residents, SB 209, which looks to form a central hub for threat, wildfire threat assessments and weather forecasting. SB 560, which looks to advance greater coordination with energy and telephone utilities to ensure, like water, that there's telephone service available in the event of wildfire, so individuals could be reached that way. Switching over to 2020, it is a presidential election year. There are also a number of seats in the state legislature that will be up. Currently, we are facing a vacancy in Senate District 28 with the departure of Senator Jeff Stone. That has potential to translate into a vacancy in the Assembly, given the outcome of the election. However, regardless of whatever the outcome is in that legislation, in that seat, staff will continue to work aggressively to ensure that we are able to brief the new representative and his or her staff on the priority issues of the district. Implementation of the Safe and Affordable Drinking Water Fund under the passage of SB 200 will be a big priority for the district. The State Board is currently in the process of selecting the Safe and Affordable Drinking Water Advisory Group, which will be instrumental in selecting the projects and criteria for the funding implementation plans that will be annually adopted. OEHA is expected to complete their Assessing Human Rights Water Report, and State Board will also be concluding their efforts on the AB 401 report that is 2 years overdue. So we deeply anticipate some legislation involving some portion of either system affordability or affordability by residents on water. Of course, SB 4014 will continue to be a priority for the district, and as I indicated earlier, we will continue to seek consensus on any outstanding items. Constituents of emerging concern and maximum contaminant level processes or development processes will be looked at as, you know, CMUA and Metropolitan Water District will be co-sponsoring legislation on the process for regulating constituents of emerging concern. And AQUA has an outstanding bill that was held last year that looks at giving additional time to a water system that's looking to comply with an MCL. And finally, wildfire, again, will pick up, and we will definitely see more legislation on that front on the inverse condemnation side. On the backup generator testing and use of those generators during PSP events, and then also the usage of PSPS as a tool for managing wildfire. So I'll stop here. I know you have a lengthy agenda, but if you have any answering questions.
So I understand the power stuff. They had an 8-hour meeting.
Yeah.
The other day, which was kind of enlightening. Michael Brocadero and Beth also gave us an update yesterday at SAPA. One of the things that I would have been concerned about is they start doing stuff that's going to create an issue for individual districts, land use districts, cities, counties, on they're not going to allow any more uses up close to the hills or brush or something else, which means then to comply with everything else the state wants, you're going to have more high rises, more this, more infill, which is going to be an impact on infrastructure for water districts. And so they said, you know, chances are that's what's going to come out of this power thing. is also going to be something on land use. It's going to be interesting to see. So,
land use is going to be the next phase of targeted areas on a variety of fronts. It's definitely right. going to be on the wildfire discussion, absolutely. There's going to be some conversation in the affordability realm as they look at the goods and services that have been provided to the historically under invested communities. So land use is going to definitely be looked at there. As the next phase of the arena comes out, we're going to see a lot of, as you said, gentrification being a priority for both the state and the levels of government for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's affordable housing, transportation, fire prevention. I believe there's going to be a huge drive in the state towards high-density residential urban core center being prioritized and actually mandated in general plans. I mean, I think that's the outcome because you can just see it's being set up right now by all these different policy initiatives in the state. Would you say it's...
Absolutely.
Yeah, there was something at WRCOG, the last WRCOG meeting, yeah, you were there,
yeah.
And they discussed the accessory buildings,
uh-huh.
the accessory units
mm-hmm.
that are now...
Right.
Yeah, and there's certain ones that we can't charge fees on,
right.
too, depending on the square footage.
So the ones at 750 square feet and below, we cannot charge capacity charges on. There was a big push in the passage of SB 13 that increases that square foot look to ensure that it's, I believe, whatever's in this footprint of the original house cannot charge impact mitigation fees. However, the water and sewer industry was very good about carving out those connection fees for that, so that does not impact us.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
But that's the other thing. It's
right.
It goes to this trend towards higher density residential by allowing or mandating cities. I could see the state to allow people to build second units on their properties.
And so ADUs does go towards complying with the arena numbers, and there's a lot more teeth in the arena this cycle.
Right. Yeah.
One of the things that Michael mentioned yesterday was that they have now begun the environmental stuff on the tunnel. Is that true?
I didn't think so.
Well, it depends on discussions.
Yeah,
or something.
Defined stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say yes if it's that's a pretty broad category, but I mean, still waiting for a project. From the administration, there has been an indication that we'd be able to do engineering and environmental at the same time, which to me sounds like a hell of a risk. But I know that there is data being collected on boring samples. I understand that. I don't remember exactly which agency in the Bay Area. As you know, they did their tunnel. Nobody knows that, but they have some core samples that they've been sharing that have been very helpful. So there's things in progress, but I don't know to what degree, and I don't know when you talk about environmental exactly what that means.
Yeah, I don't know either. And the other one was bills coming forward that was probably there was a new council that they didn't know how to work with. Something about it was on the coastline was an obscure group appointed by the state that reviews any new outfalls.
Oh, okay.
And so it came up is that they're not going to allow any more outfalls, ocean discharge. So what does that do? Is that just eliminates a desalination program? For ocean desal. And so it was, it just seems like California had a lot of things that is they're going to stop everything, which led me into, you know, I've been to conferences in Texas now for the last, 6 weeks. And it was amazing to have the executive director of the Texas Water Development Board stand up and say they're going through 50-year water sustainability analysis on what it's going to take for Texas to supply water for the next 50 years. My comment was, we can't even in California, we're so progressive, we can't think 5 years down the road, you know. But they were saying that they're going to make sure that they take care of all immigration in the next 50 years, and they said that immigration is not from the south. That immigration is from the west, north, and east. And so they're taking care of everything. I just hope at some point that somebody in the state would go down and talk to Texas to see what they're doing. They have 2.5 billion acre feet of brackish water to varying degrees, but they're going to mine it. You know, that's going to be some of their water supply. We don't do too much here. So Michael, you know, just said that maybe someone needs to initiate that discussion at the state, or make the overture to the state. You know, how far down the line are they looking here to see what we really need? And I would hope we take a part of sort of looking at that.
I think we're going to see a lot of shifting and redirecting in that manner as the water resiliency portfolio comes out from the administration. We were expecting to see something in September. There's been unfortunately some stuff on that, but maybe there'll be that sort of forward-looking planning element to it. Definitely understood that there's some opportunities.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to find out how far out are they looking. Are they looking at 10 years? Are they looking at 15? Are they looking at 50?
They're looking at 50, the long term.
Okay.
I want to thank Danielle. She does an outstanding job representing us in Sacramento, working with the associations, being part of the association's ledge committee, working with our lobbying team in keeping us informed, has testified this, just done everything for us. So I just want to thank you. And I encourage you to look through this compendium of the 2019 legislative year. It has both state and federal. As Danielle mentioned, Jolene is going to come and give a report on the federal side. But I just want to thank Danielle for all the work she's done. She's been a great partner this year in advancing a lot of, and really, I think, adding so much credibility to our legislative program and Eastern Municipal Water District. So thank you, Danielle.
Your name in Easterns was mentioned a number of times yesterday by Michael and Beth as being somebody's absolute leaders in some legislative content that goes on at the state. So thank you for that.
I would concur. I know Danielle is very familiar with Ontario Airport at 6:30 in the morning.
She's a frequent flyer.
Yes. But it's a lot of hard work, and I would concur. We have a valuable asset in Danielle for all she does for us in the state. So thank you.
Thank you. Absolutely. Thank you.
I'd add something, but you're just blushing already.
Yeah.
You did a great job.
And I'm grateful.
All right. Thank you. With that, we'll go to agenda item 7, which is receive and file and accept a motion and a second for approval of items 7A through 7B.
Move approval.
Second.
Been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries unanimously. With that, we'll go to the calendar review. Nicole?
Good morning, President Sullivan, members of the board. Attached to your calendar review today is a flyer for one event. The district will be participating in the City of Moreno Valley Snow Day on Saturday, December 7th at 9 a.m. The district will have a booth at this event if anyone is interested in attending. Moving to page 2, we've got the board's master calendar with events coming up between today and our December 11th board meeting. Beginning with tomorrow, we have the board's executive committee meeting at 7:30 a.m. for Directors Swanson and Sullivan. And at 3:30 p.m., the joint meeting with Western Municipal Water District, and that's also Directors Swanson and Sullivan. On Monday, November 25th, we have a tour and briefing with Colonel Coburn at 8 a.m., which is on Director Sullivan's calendar. And it will begin here at AMWD. Monday the 25th at 9 a.m., Director Corona has an outreach meeting with April Cody in Temecula. And Director Slauson has an update meeting with the General Manager at 11:30 a.m. in Moreno Valley. At 4 p.m. on the 25th, we have the Hemet Central Water Master meeting here at the district, Director Polly's calendar.
Correct.
Tuesday, November 26th at 11 a.m., the judging for the annual poster contest will take place here in the boardroom. We have Director Polly scheduled to attend if any other board members would like to join.
I know it's a fun event. I'm booked.
On Tuesday, November 26th as well, at 3:30 p.m., the Board Operations and Engineering Committee will meet Director Slauson and Sullivan. Wednesday, November 25th, Director Sullivan has an update meeting with the General Manager at 7:30 a.m. On Monday, December 2nd, Director Polly has an update meeting with Deputy General Manager Laura Namora at 7:30 a.m. in Paris. And the WR COG Executive Committee will meet at 2 p.m. on December 2nd, Director Slauson's calendar. Tuesday, December 3rd through Friday, December 6th, the Aqua Fall Conference will take place in San Diego. Several board members are attending and staff. Included in your folders is a list of special events taking place during Aqua that the board has been invited to participate in. Please review that list and let me know if there are any events you'd like to attend, and I can RSVP on your behalf. On Monday, December 9th and Tuesday, December 10th, the Metropolitan Water District Board and Committee meetings will take place. Monday, December 9th, the Board Administrative Committee will meet at 7:30 a.m. for Directors Polly and Sullivan. That is a reschedule. Tuesday, December 10th, Director Sullivan has an update meeting with the General Manager at noon. And on December 10th as well, we have a joint meeting with Elsinore Valley Water District at 3:30 p.m. for Directors Corona and Polly. And that meeting will be here at the district. Moving to page 3 of your calendar review, upcoming meetings and special events are listed through February of 2020. Upcoming board meetings are listed and review schedules are noted. The committees are also listed with reschedules noted. Joint interagency meetings and the district holiday schedule is listed for your review. Do you have any questions or additions to the calendar? That concludes my report. Thank you.
Thanks, Nicole. Okay, with that, we'll go to the director's reports. Steve?
I attended the Rancho California Water District meeting. It was a very short meeting. They only had one item on the regular agenda, and that was to have a voting member for the Aqua Conference.
Okay. Randy.
So, special board meeting November 12th at Metropolitan, and that was to approve the settlement offer to San Diego County Water Authority. I have missed a couple of meetings here, so I'm going to go through some other meetings that I attended previously. MWD meeting October 3rd. Joint Inland and Orange County Caucus meeting, review of met agenda, always a good discussion. Same with the standing committee board meetings, October 7th and 8th. We did have a board director's retreat in Pasadena, October 21st and 22nd, which I thought was an excellent effort. And the chairwoman, Gray, was adamant that she hear from all directors there, and it was a very good discussion. California Farm Water Coalition meeting, October 28th. I represent Metropolitan on that board. It's a very good organization that does really good outreach for ag water. And Finance and Insurance Committee meeting prep as vice chair of the Finance Committee. We have a meeting to go over the agenda with the chair of the committee, which was Glenn Day, but is now going to be Jesus Quiñones. I'm not sure we've had an attorney as the finance chair, but anyway, that should be interesting. UMWD meetings on October 29th, a meeting with staff from Western Municipal to talk about Monday morning group issues for Sacramento. Good meeting. October 30th, update with general manager. Always good. Again, October 31st, joint Inland Orange County Caucus meeting. Good discussion on MET agenda. And then standing committee and board meetings for Eastern shouldn't be on there. I did discuss the planning committee agenda with our general manager because I couldn't be there for the actual meeting. DVL Memorandum of Intent Information Committee on November 13th was a good discussion, and as well as the update with general manager. That's all I have.
That's quite a bit. Thank you. Phil?
All right. I had a meeting with Craig Hughes of the Audubon Society. They do our bird tours, and he had some ideas on how we could improve the experience. And I'm going to have some follow-up meetings with the general manager in April. He has actually some ideas I think we could incorporate that would be beneficial to both that group and the district. I just was on the CalDESA Regulatory Working Group conference call, and as Director Sullivan indicated, there is some renewed interest in the legislature about discharging salt back into the ocean. So that's some concern on ocean desal in the state. French Valley Air Show, Supervisor Washington invited me to be his guest there, and that was good. Got some time with the supervisor. The sixth annual business outreach luncheon I thought was just outstanding here. And I too like to, Alan Freetag, I think, did a very nice job of organizing that. So kudos to Alan, and got to talk to a lot of our vendors, and I think that's just a really good event. I did not get to be on the CalDESAL Executive Committee call the other day. Domingone Basin Working Group, we had a very productive meeting. A couple of the stakeholders wanted to take the group in different directions about forming kind of a working group away from the technical advisory group. Kudos to Joe and Al Javier directing. Sometimes those meetings get a little cantankerous, and Joe has the ability to bring them back to point, and so thank you for that. Last night I attended the annual Ring Cross Trophy Dinner with the 4th Air Force with Director Sullivan. Outstanding event. I think that helps us with some of the things that we do at March, and I was glad to participate. And then this morning I did not get to attend the Murata Wildemar Chamber event.
Okay, with that, I was at the National Water Resources Association annual conference in Houston. It was a good conference. There was a lot of legislative people from the state of Texas. You know, obviously, outreach was on water and what they do. Also, I'd just say that EMWD's contribution to perhaps change the contract for the NWRA executive director has moving forward to have some sort of a change, and at least they appointed five people from five different states to review that and to come up with a recommendation of a new contract. I did, like Phil said, the annual business outreach luncheon was a big success. And there was a number of people afterwards that said, you know, it's things like this that sets this district apart from everybody else in Southern California. No one else would ever think about doing this. And you can't believe the amount of great PR and the help that this gives to everybody. And when you look at what, you know, the region that we cover and the opportunity for business here, they were just ecstatic about it. The other was the Inland Center for Sustainable Development. I actually won the lottery to represent Randy and Paul since they couldn't be there. But it was
congratulations.
That's what they said. I won the lottery. So it was interesting, you know. Public policy, you know, I think it'll be a real benefit for Eastern to be a participant. And certainly hope that Randy makes the next one. I think they're looking forward to seeing you there. Santa Ana Watershed Project Authority Commission meeting yesterday was a good meeting. We had West Coast Advisors, which was Michael Brocadero and Beth Alasso, share with us what's going on in Sacramento. Made my other comments. The other was that we approved two decent-sized technical assistance contracts. The one that really is within Eastern's purview is for Saboba, and I think their figure was $350,000 to replace asbestos-lined pipes that were put in 1910. So it was a nice thing. They're going to do their engineering with that. The annual Rain Cross dinner last night I thought was absolutely exceptional. There were more people in uniform than there were civilians last night. I thought it was excellent, and to watch retired Major General Roth, now Senator Roth, conduct that meeting last night just shows how much of a consummate professional this gentleman is. So that's all I got to say. We'll look forward to the next one. Oh, I'm sorry, David Slauson. How did I slip by that one?
But I did not attend the RCC annual dinner. I did attend yesterday's meeting with the foundation board, and they approved their audit committee report. The audit was done by an outside CPA. They also, we had a presentation from the RCC chancellor, and he told us they're going to propose a bond, and it's going to be rather fast track. I think it was $73 million to be voted on in March of 2020.
Really?
Yeah.
Fast. Yeah, a bond came up yesterday, Michael Brocadero, saying that the state is going to be looking at doing one for $15 billion. For water. Didn't think it was going to, the polling's not going well. So, anyway, before we go to closed session, we need to just suspend the
recess.
We're just going to recess the board meeting and go to Eastern Municipal Water District's Financing Authority for November the 20th, 2019.